Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And even though we are the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, we definitely believe that good advocacy does not have state line borders. So we have one of our few, but hopefully not too few in the near future, out-of-state guests. Our guest today is Professor Beth Walensky, who is a clinical professor of law at the University of Michigan. Beth, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for our listeners, you know, a lot of them, I think, have gone to Texas law schools and probably don't know a whole lot about you or the University of Michigan. Can you just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, your background?
Sure. So I teach almost exclusively in Michigan's legal analysis, writing, and research course. Our first year course is called Legal Practice. I've been doing that for, this is now my 18th year on the faculty teaching this class. Before that, I practiced law, big law firm. Actually, I practiced law at Akin Gump, which I think of, I was in DC, but of course it's a, I still think of it as a Texas law firm. As I know, you know, people have been around for a while, I think tend to do. In fact, I visited the Texas offices a few times while I was practicing law. I did mostly administrative and appellate work while I was there, the thing that made me happiest, and probably the part of practicing law that I probably the only part that I still miss is actually getting to sit in my office and think about and research and write a brief on a sort of thorny legal question. So yeah, so I did that. And then, you know, I'm a Midwesterner. My husband's a Midwesterner, and we kind of landed back in Michigan. And I took this position at the University of Michigan Law School thinking, well, this will be fun to do for a couple of years and I'll figure out what I really want to do. And 18 years later, it turns out the thing that I really am passionate about doing is teaching legal analysis and writing and research to law students.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Do you just teach that one class to multiple section, or do you teach some other writing-based classes as well?
Almost exclusively the first year legal required first year course. And I teach usually two sections of students, about 20 students each, and I have them all year. So I get 40 students who I get to know really, really well, not just because there's only 40 of them, but because the model that we use involves lots and lots and lots of individual meetings with my students to talk about their work. I have taught a smattering of other classes, sort of as the need arises. We have a problem solving initiative that I co-taught a class in, and not on a legal writing topic. And I've taught some fun kind of mini seminars in my home, which is kind of like a Michigan thing where faculty get to pick a fun law adjacent topic and you have 10 to 12 students come to your house for dinner about six times over the year and talk about stuff. So, but mostly it's legal writing.
You know, for those of us that practice, I know I spend a lot of time legal writing, and I spend a lot of time thinking about how best to write, but I've never really spent a lot of time thinking about teaching legal writing. How was the transition process for you going from practicing to then actually teaching it to someone?
Yeah, so it was rough, right? So I often think back to the students I had my first year of teaching, and I feel like I poured my heart and soul into it, and I still kind of feel bad for them because I think anybody who has ever taught for a living will tell you that the first time they do it, well, fortunately, there's a steep learning curve, because I think my second year I was better, and my third year, you know, even better than that. So, you know, learning how there's the different approach that you take to giving somebody feedback in practice, for example. I mean, I was a mid-level associate when I left Akin Gump. So I'd had junior associates doing work for me. I'd had summer associates doing work for me. So I had, you know, plenty of experience giving feedback to colleagues, junior colleagues in practice, and that was somewhat helpful. But the world of moving into teaching legal writing to first-year law students is quite different, partly because there's a difference between somebody walking in the door to law school who knows nothing about how to read a case, how to research, how to synthesize rules from cases, you know, which courts are bind other courts. What do you do if you've got like a Ninth Circuit decision that's deciding a question of California law? Is that binding on a California state court, right? All of these things that practicing attorneys tend to know that first-year law students don't. But giving feedback on writing that a law student does, it's a different kind of enterprise than giving feedback to someone in practice for a lot of different reasons. Now, there are certainly overlaps, right? Especially if you're the kind of practicing attorney who is committed to mentoring and sort of helping grow your, you know, junior attorneys that you work with. The attitude that you bring to providing them with feedback on their work is hopefully quite similar to the attitude we bring, which is an attitude of we're here to help. Right? We want to help you get better. And we want to help you develop the ability to recognize some of the things that we're pointing out on your own so that you can now make those changes on your own in the next thing, right, that you write. But yeah, sort of making that shift was harder than I thought it would be. I thought, well, yeah, I mean, like you write, like, so I know how to write. I know how to practice law. So therefore, I can teach this. It turns out, like, you have to learn how to teach it. Unfortunately, there are lots of great resources out there that I continue to rely on to this day on the pedagogy of what we do when we teach law students.
Oh, I can't wait to explore the pedagogy, because I all I'm thinking about sitting here is how different must it be today than it was even, you know, when you went to school in the 90s. I also went to law school in the 90s, and I think back to my legal writing curriculum, such as it was. And I also think about, well, you know, maybe I could teach a class adjunct legal writing. I just don't think that what I know in my head translates very well into the classroom. But what would you say is the biggest difference between, say, the style of curriculum that you took in as a law student versus how your department approaches legal writing in Michigan?
Yeah, I want to back up and say, like, I do think that adjunct professors can be great. I think there are great opportunities for them to get involved in some of what we do in teaching at law schools. So we can talk about that, because I think that there's sort of the sweet spot is somebody who, you know, is a great practicing attorney who's committed to learning, like, how do I translate this into what law students, how to teach law students. So, but yeah, so, you know, so where, you know, what are the changes, right? So when I was in law school, my legal writing class was taught by either a 2L or a 3L who reviewed, you know, this is somebody who'd never practiced law, hadn't passed the bar, reviewed, like, you know, sort of basically said, here's IRAC, right? You remember, like, issue rule application conclusion, and said, here's a memo, and now here are some cases, right? Now go write a memo. And it was formulaic for the sort of end goal of being formulaic so that you could write to the formula. And it wasn't, I mean, I remember actually very little about it. Didn't make much of an impression. Don't think it had much of an impact on what kind of, you know, lawyer I became. I mean, I think my best sort of the way that I became a good lawyer is that I had outstanding attorneys that I worked for who really were patient and mentored me. So, you know, when we teach students, you know, my goal is to kind of constantly be thinking about where do I want them to be in 8 months, the end of the school year. So where do I need them to be at the end of the semester? So where do I need them to be at the end of this sort of 3-week unit? So, you know, what do I need to be doing with them today? And there's a sort of, so for example, like I start with a formula and I use an acronym called CREAC, which is just another version of IRAC, right? It stands for conclusion, rule, application, explanation, application, maybe counteranalysis. But the point is not, this is the formula that you always have to use. The point is, let's learn how to use this formula, because doing that will help you understand how to synthesize rules across cases, right? Because one thing that you're sort of beginning law students want to do is they can read cases and they can do what I call like the book report. Like they can tell you what the case says after they've gotten a little bit of experience, but being able to tell you what the case doesn't say, but when you read 3 or 4 or 6 cases, you can say, aha, this seems to be what courts are doing in this jurisdiction with this legal question, right? We kind of go deep into that using this formula. When we talk about the E in Kriya, the explanation, what we're really doing there, it's not just, can you get the words on the page that describe this court decision? It's, can you recognize which facts from this case really mattered to the outcome, right? So we're using it as a means of getting students to engage in legal analysis and understand how attorneys actually, you know, my view is that most attorneys are actually doing a version of this in their heads, even if they don't realize it, right? You know, you both are experienced attorneys. You read cases and you can probably read 5 or 6 or 7 cases and maybe without even thinking about it, get to the point where you say, oh, I see what's going on, right? Here's the key point that I want to make, or here's a rule that I can extract that I can argue to a court is, you know, what it actually ought to do. We break that process down into very small, discrete steps so that then later on in the semester, we can say, now let's play around with it, right? You don't always have to do exactly this in exactly this order, but in learning how to do this in a particular way, we've now, you can recognize, you've developed some skills that enable you to recognize some broader themes in how attorneys go about analyzing a set of legal documents. So that's one example of how we do that.
That's almost like a practice course. I mean, because that is really a hard dose of reality in terms of what lawyers do day in, day out, especially in today's world where it's not just, you know, going off and taking depositions. You're doing a whole lot of legal analysis. I'm sure it's the same in Michigan and many other jurisdictions as it is here. But, you know, we like to say that lawyers are essentially professional writers, and you're doing that kind of analysis all the time to convey and try to persuade the court at whatever level it is that your position is correct. But that what you're describing is, I mean, something that I think Jody and I do on a daily basis in our practice. Mm-hmm.
I know, but you know, when you sit down, you might, you know, at least my experience, and most people I know who practice law or write for a living have the experience of thinking like, I think I know what I want to say, but let me write it. And then writing it, you figure out, oh, I'm not as clear on this one point because if I can't get the words to come together in the right way on the page, it may mean that I don't have a good enough understanding of what I want to say, right? So like the writing as sort of being part of the thinking process and this kind of recursive, I'm going to think about it, then I'm going to write, and the writing is going to help me think about it more and realize what parts of it, like where do I have gaps? So yeah, absolutely.
The synthesizing the rule across the cases, that skill is one that I definitely had to develop over the years, like you said, you know, reading multiple cases and coming up with, aha, this is where we're going and this is what we need to talk about. And that is not where we spent our time in my legal writing class in law school, at least. It was, here's the legal topic that we want you to write your memo on. Here's the legal topic we want you to write your appellate brief on. And here's the cases that you need to go find. And it wasn't really synthesizing all that together and coming up with an analysis. And I love that y'all are really digging into that, because that is such an important skill, no matter what type of law you practice, really, but particularly litigation practices and appellate practices every day. That's all you do.
Yeah, you got to be able to cut through the fluff. And that sounds like you're really teaching students how to do that without, you know, what, if you see a pattern after reading half a dozen cases, you may not need to go on and read 20 cases or 25 cases and to get the gist of what's going on. And as a real world practitioner, you don't always have time to read 20 or 25 cases. You need to pick that pattern out, you know, much faster. So that's really great what y'all are doing as far as that approach. I think it's a fabulous skill to be teaching at the first year law student level.
I have, you know, this week is my students are doing their first big research assignment. And this week I've been in individual conferences with them, sort of like, you know, each one after another. And one of the things that they all want to know is like, well, I get faster at this, right? It takes me forever still. I mean, they're already faster at reading a case than they were in week five or six of the semester. But, you know, I get like this huge list of cases that I think is relevant and sort of helping them figure out, okay, now how do I sort of identify which ones I want to skim? And then how do I skim a case? And then which ones do I need to read carefully? And how do I read carefully? Is so much of this, I tell them over and over again, it just takes practice, right? Like all of it, like the right writing is a muscle, right? The more you write, the better you're going to get at it. Reading cases, same thing. Being able to identify patterns when you're reading cases, same thing. You know, like they don't have enough law under their belts to be able to kind of pick out the pattern because they haven't yet gotten exposed enough to how judges make decisions, for example. So that's one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about. Like, what do you think is motivating this judge in this case? And what does that tell us generally about what judges care about and things like that.
That is a great perspective to bring into it, because that's definitely something that we didn't really, I didn't spend a lot of time on, you know, learning. You learned the form, you learned, like you said, the IRAC sort of formula, and you wrote to that formula, but you didn't really spend a lot of time thinking objectively or subjectively necessarily about what is the decision maker, you know, what's driving them in this particular case. It's what does this case say? What's the rule? How do we put it in here and throw it in? I love that you kind of deconstruct that stuff to come out.
We also, you know, we want them to walk away with transferable skills. If you teach them how to write to one formula that works in this one kind of very narrow, if you have a legal question that's got like fits these parameters, that's not all that useful, right? Like that only works if they happen to get out into practice and everything they get is like a question that looks exactly like, not necessarily substantively, but fits within those parameters that you can write to that formula. So we want to teach like sort of foundational skills that they can then in lots of different kinds of legal questions and in lots of different environments will, you know, sort of serve them well.
You know, it seems like from what you're telling me and what you teach that it has really moved away from just sort of the formulaic approach to more of an experiential analytical teaching practice. I don't know if that's the right words to use for it, but it seems like that's kind of how it has developed, because it was very sort of cut and dry. I remember we spent so much time on citation form, which obviously is important. And then just sort of learning, okay, here's these styles and these are the styles you need to know and go do one of these. Okay, you did one of them. Great. Check that box. Now you're done with legal writing. But I'd like that you really dig more into the process than the outcome. It seems like that's something that has shifted.
Yeah, you know, and so there's a couple of sort of themes that I think I try to impart in my students across the year that's not just about the straight legal analysis, but developing as a professional writer, right? And process is definitely one of them, to understand that, you know, we talked a little bit about the recursive nature of like writing is thinking. And so you got to think through the problem, then you got to research the problem. And then at some point you have to start writing, but you also have to leave time to go back and do more thinking, right? So, and understanding, you know, this is one of the things that was the hardest for me in terms of like developing as a writer. And one of the points at which I think I made my greatest strides forward as a writer is when I finally got comfortable writing the garbage draft, right? Just like get some words on the page, because you don't have anything to revise until the words are on the page, and sort of getting past the, I don't want to write this sentence if it's not going to be perfect, and just kind of getting this stuff out. So sort of really teaching my students how to get your ideas on the page so you have something to work with. Understand that revision is a really substantive, essential part of the process, right? It's not like, oh, I need to set aside time to, you know, read through it, proofread, fix some little style things. Like you might need time to kind of completely rethink major parts of it. So certainly writing as a process is something I talk a lot about. I talk to my students a lot about reflection, right? And this is both as a law student and something that I hope will serve them well in their careers. Spending time sort of taking stock, right? Like, especially as a junior attorney, you may be getting feedback from 3 or 4 or 5 different senior colleagues on your writing, and spending time sort of sitting down, right, whenever you get a breather between cases, to say, I'm going to go back and see what kind of feedback I've been getting and see if there are themes that emerge, right? It's almost like you're synthesizing the feedback from that you've gotten. Oh, wow, it looks like, you know, people I've been working with are really impressed with my ability to do X, but I keep getting the same kinds of comments over and over on this other thing. Now I know what I need to work on. So we do some of that in my class. And also just thinking of all of the things we teach is kind of like part of being a lifelong learner, right? Like I'm still, as a, you know, someone who's been teaching this class for many years, still trying to learn how to be better at teaching it, still looking for opportunities to be better at writing. I took on a project a couple of years ago. I'm really interested in metaphors in legal writing, and I don't think I'm very good at coming up with metaphors. So I decided I was going to spend a summer kind of trying to like create and design my own sort of personal curriculum around the use of metaphor in legal writing, because you can never stop learning how to be better at what you do. And I want my students to think of this that way too.
Is there an element to your course in how to delicately tell a senior partner that their editing suggestions are wrong?
I could use that lesson still sometimes.
It definitely comes up, right? So, I mean, we can look at it from both directions, because one of the things I want my students to learn how to do is to give feedback to other people, right? So I actually have a class day coming up in a few weeks where we engage in sort of a peer review, where like one of the things I want them to learn is like, how do you say this, you know, how do you make suggestions to someone? Yeah, so... And then one of the things we also talk about is, you know, different people have different sort of personal perspectives. I try to point out when like I'm sort of identifying something that might be hopefully not unique to me, but where there are differences of opinions about whether you know, some people would write it this way. Some people, this happens particularly in persuasive writing. Like some people would think that's a little bit too assertive, strong, over the top. Some people would be, you know, fine with it. So I definitely try to point out places where there might be differences of opinions. I invite students to share the differences of opinions. But yeah, like what do you say when you're getting sort of some edits from a senior attorney and you think they're just wrong? Whew. I think I would probably ask, like sort of probing, like, can you explain a little bit, because I thought that, you know, or I was taught, or I'm pretty sure, or look, I found this sort of legal writing sort of, you know, book by this judge, which says X and Y and Z. So I'm just kind of confused about what, there are delicate ways to do it, but it also depends on who you're talking to. So
I appreciate that answer. I really meant it as sort of a rhetorical question, but
it's an important skill for junior attorneys. It absolutely is.
It is an important skill for older attorneys sometimes too, when you have to delicately talk to someone and explain to them why their position needs some further thought, perhaps, is a nice way to put that.
Further thought. I like that.
But, you know, on the idea of lifelong learners, which is something we should all aspire to, what are things that practicing attorneys maybe didn't learn in their legal writing class, or things that maybe you see from professional attorneys that you kind of wish that they knew or did differently? Or maybe you tell your students, hey, here's a great example of something you shouldn't do. Are there things out there that you see as someone who's teaching a new generation of legal writers that you wish you could impart to older attorneys?
I have colleagues at some schools who like to use like the really, you know, horrific examples of attorneys like, you know, really behaving badly, or, you know, producing a brief that's just, it's terrible in every respect. I actually find those to be not so useful because they're so extreme. Like they don't really teach. I find sort of the more subtle things more useful. Like I like to show, and again, we have disagreements on this, but I'll show students, you know, sort of competing motions that were filed in an actual case, or competing briefs that were filed in an actual case. And we'll spend time kind of, you know, sort of breaking them down. And one of the questions that often arises is, do you think this attorney went too far, right? Like, is this introduction effective because it captured your attention? Or do you walk away from this introduction thinking like it's too, you know, sort of snarky or argumentative, or like, I don't understand what the story is here. One of the things that I really try to talk a lot about in persuasive writing is, you know, by the time we get to second semester, students are pretty good at taking the law, synthesizing rules, applying it to facts. They're not so good at telling a story. So we see lots of examples of this. I can, you know, sort of show them like an introduction that basically just sort of says, here are the arguments we're making in this brief, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and therefore we should win. I'm like, okay, but what, right? Like, what's your core theory? So we have a class where we kind of like give them some actual materials from a fight in the Ann Arbor City Council here, you know, where I live, about a zoning issue. And like, you know, there are lots, I gave them actual emails that like, you know, real residents wrote, and I have them say like, okay, if you're representing the residents on this side, like what's your core theory, right? And if you're representing the residents on this side, what's your core theory? So thinking about like the story. But I think other than that, you know, it's not so much mistakes. It's more, you know, I know that if I went back right now to practice law, I'd be a much better writer for having taught it. And partly it's because teaching something forces you to break down your process and think about each step. And again, a lot of those things that practicing attorneys, I think, naturally do in their heads very, very fluidly. I have even found like if I'm writing something and struggling with how it comes together, sometimes I'll go back to the basics and say like, wait, does this paragraph even have a topic sentence that works, right? And like, okay, does each paragraph have a topic sentence that tells a story, right? So these are some kind of fundamental things that, again, a lot of attorneys in most situations will do naturally. But, you know, sort of when you're struggling with something, to really remember that I can go back to the basics. Maybe I do want to figure out my PREAC, right? Or my IRAC or whatever acronym I learned, because maybe what I'm missing here is I actually don't know what the issue is, and forcing myself to like do the IRAC, where the very first thing you have to do is write the issue, is going to help me realize that. So that's one of the things that I, you know, often find can be useful even for people who've got a lot of experience.
That's a great point. I mean, those of us who have been doing this for 20 plus years, I think, and even less, could stand to sort of get back to the basics like that from time to time. And I think we talked a little bit at the beginning about, you know, the value of an adjunct professor. I think if I were going to go into a legal writing program and try to teach, that would probably be one of the biggest challenges for me, is to get it out of my head and figure out, all right, what is my actual process? What are the rules that I'm applying? But it would probably make me much like anything else, you know, the way that you learn law is to get into it and, you know, get up to your elbows in it. And I'm sure it'd be the same for legal writing. You know, the way to improve legal writing would be to really, my legal writing would be to really break it down and think about, you know, what are the steps I'm going through in this process? And, you know, not take as a given that just because I've been doing it this way for all these years, it's the right way or the best.
You know, you do a version of that every time you write something to a judge, right? I mean, you are so, by the time you like get the brief done and turn it in, or you're ready to write the brief, you are so steeped in the law and the facts of your case that you have to, you know, there's a phrase for sort of what the writing, the curse of knowledge, right? The idea being the more you know about something, the harder it is to like sort of explain it to somebody else, because you have to kind of say, you know, if I'm a, you know, a Texas appellate judge and I'm a generalist, right? What does that judge not know about this sort of like very specialized area of the law that I'm writing about, right? And she certainly doesn't know anything about the facts of this case unless I tell her what those facts are. And, you know, sort of, so if you're good at legal writing for a judge, right, you've already got the experience of having to think through, what do I need to do to explain to this person the story of this case? And so we actually do something similar when we teach. I have to think through, what do I need to, like, how do I need to break down the process that I go through? I actually just wrote, like I said, my students are working on a research assignment, and there was an interesting case which has kind of a weird notation in Westlaw that's an important case. And so I had students who asked about it because they couldn't figure out how to figure out what to do with this notation. And so I just wrote an email that sort of said, let me walk you through my process of figuring out what's going on and is this case still good law? And I kind of went step by step. And it's something that I would have done pretty quickly, clicking through the various things I need to get through online. But forcing myself to really break it down for them, I think, is a really useful way of thinking about how all of these things come together. So, yeah.
You know, my dirty little nerd secret that I don't tell people is every time I read a brief that I've written, but right before I'm done, one of the last things I do is just read the topic sentence of each paragraph of the argument section by itself. And if it makes sense, I feel like it is at least pretty cohesive, because if I can read the first sentence of every paragraph and follow along the logic that I'm following, it usually means it's okay. And so I always like to do that before I send something off.
See, Jody, you can teach this class. That's one of the things I teach my students. I teach them to read out loud. I teach them when they're really looking for sentence level things and sort of little typo mistakes to read out loud backwards sentence by sentence, because then you can't focus on the substance. You have to focus on the sentence structure. Yeah, the sort of the topic sentence thing is a version. It's an abbreviated version of the reverse outline that I teach my students, right? Like some students who either don't like to outline or do, but it still doesn't quite come together, I have them outline something that after they've actually written it. And a lot of times like the errors and like some of the organizational things will sort of rise to the surface.
For most clients, a supersedious bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedious bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
And some of what you were saying, Beth, a little while ago, reminded me of just a very important lesson that all lawyers need to keep in mind, which is know your audience. You know, it's one thing to be writing for a Texas trial judge who doesn't have a law clerk and who won't see your summary judgment motion, you know, until they actually show up for the hearing, which actually happens here in Travis County, versus writing an appellate brief for an intermediate court of appeals or the Texas Supreme Court, which is, those are even different skill sets in between those two courts. And so, you know, you're going to break your process down a little differently depending on who your audience is.
Yeah, you know, we also talk about not just writing to judge, but also how do you write to a client, right? Like, and what if, you know, and there's a difference if you're writing to a client who is, you know, coming to you for help with, you know, as a small business owner, right? Who's got a question about, you know, his lease, right? With his landlord, doesn't know about the law, versus a client who is the general counsel of a major corporation, right? And sort of what can you expect them to already know about how the law works, right? So yeah, I mean, the know your audience is a big theme of any good legal writing class.
Particularly tone, I feel like. And that's one that a lot of practicing lawyers could use a refresher course on from time to time, because it's so easy as you get further along in the practice of law to sort of forget about your tone sometimes for a whole lot of reasons. You know, so often you see a brief, whether it's on a case I'm working on or not, and your first sort of reaction is, whoa, And if I'm having that reaction as the advocate, I know the judge is having that same reaction because they definitely don't want to be dragged down into some sort of nasty legal slap fight.
It's almost like there's a little element of ethics in what you're doing too. I mean, maybe it's beyond a little element. I mean, you clearly can't do certain things in your legal writing, like name call or, you know, impugn the credibility of the judge and that sort of thing. And I'd like to think that you don't see that kind of thing in your students' writing, but I'm sure over time, you know, they develop a sense of what's really appropriate, persuasive, and what's not.
Yeah. And this, you know, comes up second semester. It's interesting. I tend to notice more when we get to persuasive writing students who don't want to be forceful enough when it comes to the law, right? Like they're, you know, like you can actually say like the court should do X, not like, well, here's kind of what the law says. So maybe the court, I mean, right. So encouraging them to actually say like, no, you actually, like the way that lawyers would say this is the court should grant the motion for summary, or the court, you know, or like they'll kind of phrase a rule in a way that, you know, sort of suggest some wiggle room when they really don't need to. But yeah, I always have some students who kind of come on too strongly in a way that I think it's often because they're not yet sure, right? They're still trying to figure out how do you use the facts and the law to actually make a forceful argument. And so this is where I think really showing them examples from the real world where, you know, they're not actually representing a party, that you can see in a much more sort of concrete way how some of those things that are like sort of the things that, you know, you think this attorney is a little bit too convinced of the righteousness of their position, right? And there's nothing wrong with being convinced of the righteousness of your position. But like, even when you are, you know, it's crystal clear, like, how could anybody disagree with me? Presenting it that way actually doesn't make you look more professional. It doesn't make your argument stronger. It probably distracts from, you know, sort of like how strong your argument is. So yeah, so we actually video a lot of fun with that because sometimes we have like really heated disagreements in class about like, is this too much? Or, you know, no, actually I really like this. This is really gripping and it's, you know, makes me wanna, even as the judge, wanna be on this person's side. So yeah, we certainly talk about what kinds of things are completely out of bounds in terms of appropriateness with taking on the judge, taking on opposing counsel, as opposed to taking on their arguments, you know, and why snark tends to not work. But yeah, you know, there are gradations and disagreements about like, okay, what is, you know, professional, what is not professional. Certainly we talk about the ethics of ethics comes up a lot when we talk about which cases can I use and how can I frame them and which cases should I not use? Or is it bad if I like don't address that one? I mean, usually it's bad because not because it's going to look like you're hiding something, because the other side's going to bring up that bad precedent. Like the problem is that you've now squandered the opportunity to take the case that you really don't like and to frame it in a way that's, you know, less damaging to your side. So
Yeah.
All things that practicing attorneys need to remember themselves, you know, and even I like to sometimes write that angry draft, you know, you just write the angry draft of something and then you sit it down and either you pick it up later and read it and go, whoa, or you just know that you're just going to write it and get it out and sit it down and then write the actual draft.
Just be very careful that you put in big bold letters at the top, angry draft, so you don't accidentally send that.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I don't even save them. You know, I'll write them, print it out, throw it away, and it's, you know, kind of cathartic, but
yeah.
You know.
That's all. Those are all great points. And then, of course, there's the creative use of ellipses that I think gets lawyers in trouble a lot.
Yeah. What did you leave out here, right?
Yeah. Where you in the quote is very important sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I teach my students, like, it's actually fine to use an ellipsis as long as what ends up on the page is faithful to the meaning of the original, right? Sometimes it's really helpful to your reader to cut out all the stuff that's not relevant, but you have to make sure that you ended up with something that, I mean, because again, there's an ethical issue there, but the bigger problem is probably your credibility, right? Which is now shattered for the whole case.
Yeah.
That's an important point. I mean, and maybe first year law students just haven't come to appreciate this point yet, but you know, if you lose credibility and you're riding with the court, that's going to follow you not only in that case, but beyond. We see it all too often.
You know, one thing that we talk about, you know, I think some of my students think, well, if I'm going to go off and practice like in a big market, you know, it doesn't matter as much because like, no one's going to remember me from one case to the next. And I explain to them, like, every legal market is small, right? If you're practicing in New York City, you're going to run into the same people. You're going to develop a reputation, not just with like opposing counsel and potential clients and colleagues, but with judges. And so, you know, you got to be thinking, you should think about that, right? It should actually impact how you decide to make an argument.
That's so true. I mean, Texas has 100,000 lawyers. And yet I think Todd and I would agree that on the appellate side of things, you really do see the same lawyers and the same judges time and time again, all over the place, despite how big our bar is.
100% agree.
One thing that we don't get enough chance to get into, though, you know, is there the, and then, you know, maybe students get this in some, in, you know, their legal ethics class to take later on, but the, you know, what do you do if you have a client who's pushing you to make the argument that you don't think you should be making, right? And you think that there's a problem there, who wants to, you know, read through the brief and wants to cut out this language from the quote and just stick an ellipsis in, right? Now you've got a little bit of an issue with the client, but it's your reputation on the line because you're the one signing the document, so.
Those conversations don't ever get any easier either. No. What are things that attorneys need to keep in mind when you're working with someone who's fresh out of law school or sort of a young legal writer? You know, what are things to remember when you're mentoring them and trying to give feedback and help them learn?
Oh, that's a great question. So I think it's just important, like, you know, sort of figure out, what's your relationship with this junior attorney, right? Is this kind of like a one-off thing that I'm just working with this person once, or is this potentially, you know, something that I'm going to be working with this person for a longer period of time? Because I think the best mentors are very intentional about what they do and how they go about doing it. And just to sort of, like, you know, sort of, we think about who our audience is when we're writing and figuring out what, how to frame something on the page, right? If I'm giving feedback to someone who's just working with me on one assignment, like, I might be thinking differently about how I can be helpful to that person than if it's someone who I know I'm going to see a lot, and we can kind of be a little more intentional about, you know, where do you want to go? But I'd say, first of all, ask, right? Like, if you are working with a junior associate, a junior attorney, I think I'd want to know, like, you know, I think I would offer, like, I really want to be helpful to you. I want to help you grow and develop as an attorney. Here are some ideas that I have for how I can do that. Like, if you're giving me work, like, maybe, you know, I'll give you feedback on everything, but we'll talk about a couple of individual things and think about where you want to be 6 months or a year from now. Are there things that you would find helpful, right? Now I'm a junior attorney, that you feel like you really want to work on, right? Maybe you've got a second year associate who says, I think I'm ready to start taking depositions, right? Like, how do I get to that point? So I would definitely ask, both for your own benefit and also because I think junior attorneys need to be reminded and encouraged to think about their own professional development, right? Like, it's very easy to kind of, you get out, you pass the bar, you have your first job, and like, there's just a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we forget to sit and, again, sort of reflect. You know, I tell my students, like, maybe twice a year, maybe it's daylight savings time, right? Or maybe once a year on your birthday, you kind of like set aside time that week to say, like, what have I done this past year and where do I want to be going, right? What are the things I'd like to do in the next year in terms of developing? So I would say it's a conversation, right? To sort of figure out, how can I be the most helpful? What kind of mentor does this person need? And then, you know, when you're practicing law, you don't often have the opportunity to sit and reflect while you're working on the document, right? Like, the kind of feedback that I give to my students, right, is it's more measured, right? And I give them the feedback. I try not to make changes in their work, with a few rare exceptions. I tend to do a lot of margin comments where I point things out, I ask questions, I suggest, like, maybe you should go reread this part of the case, I'm not sure you've got it right. You know, that's a luxury that you don't have usually in practice, because you've got a deadline, right? And you've just got to change it and file it. One suggestion that I often make to practicing attorneys who really do want to, you know, sort of mentor and help along junior attorneys in their writing in particular, but also within the realities of a busy law practice, is go ahead and make the changes, right? If you need to do that. And then, you know, like, once the brief is filed, the, you know, deadline, everything's passed, you can actually say to the attorney, like the junior attorney, here's something we could do. Why don't you take the draft that I sent you when I made all these changes and, I, you know, identify a couple and say, let's come have a conversation about why I made those changes. Or I want you to sort of see, like, why do you think I moved these paragraphs around, or I cut this argument, or I changed the way this sentence is framed, right? And like, there are still times within the practice of law to have those conversations, but usually not when the deadline, not before the thing is filed. But, you know, that's, you know, sort of something that fits within the realities of law practice that still enables you as the senior attorney, if necessary, to just, you know, rewrite stuff that needs to be rewritten, mm-hmm. but still recognizes that there's benefit to talking about it afterwards.
That's great advice, because it's so hard to kind of find that balance, especially in a time sensitive situation, between, you know, wanting to give feedback, wanting to help someone to find their own voice, and just having to get it done and get it out the door. It's such a tough trade off.
But it is so important, no matter what the size of the firm, to develop your junior lawyers and for them to really understand the why of things. Because, I mean, so often the culture of a law firm is, well, you just got to do it the partner's way. Or, you know, the senior partner's way, and just don't ask questions. Don't ask why, just do it. And that really doesn't help the junior lawyer develop themselves as a lawyer. And I think it's really bad for the firm too, because, well, there's lots of reasons why that would be, but the mentoring aspect of this, I just think we have to encourage the more senior lawyers at all levels to do something like what you're describing and take the time. If you're going to redline somebody's draft or bleed all over it with red ink, or just make the changes in the interest of a deadline, visit with a junior lawyer and explain your position and have something to back it up other than just, well, that's not how I do things.
I've been on the receiving end of some red writing before for, and you look at it and some of them are changes that make sense. And some of them are just kind of like, wow, that's an incredibly personal comment for no good reason.
I was just very, very lucky, right? I mean, like when I sort of lucked into working with some outstanding attorneys, it was an aching gump, right? Dan Joseph was an attorney that I worked with for most of my time, most closely at Aiken Gump. And when I would send something to him, he would send it back down to me and he might like change two words. And then he would write like two paragraphs in the margin to me explaining why he changed those. Mm-hmm. Like, that's very unusual to have that kind of sort of person saying, no, I really want you to know like what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. But
yeah
it was really a wonderful experience.
I've been really lucky to have some very good mentors that are the same way about giving really substantive feedback, or just, even just in person as we're going through a draft, just sit down and let's talk about, I have one view on this, you have another view, let's figure out why we have those views and come to a resolution. I mean, those are so valuable to be able to have those conversations and have kind of a safe space to have those conversations, because so often it doesn't feel like a safe space when there's someone who holds so much power in a law firm, a client relationship, whatever it is, and someone who's just starting out on their career. It's hard to, sit in there and feel the imbalance and really want to speak up.
Good point about the client. The client too, mm-hmm. is like, sometimes no matter what your level of seniority in the firm, you have to have those conversations with clients about the reasons why, as you were alluding to earlier, why things can't be a certain way, why you can't take a certain tact. But it all kind of comes back to, communication and trying to be a unified team for the benefit of your client and being a persuasive advocate, which puts your client in the best position ultimately.
Yeah.
We have a few minutes left. If you've still got time, Beth, since you're here, we kind of just wanted to talk a little bit about legal academia. It's not something that Todd and I have much experience in or kind of have a foothold in, but I know that it's something that a lot of lawyers or law students may have an interest in doing, either, professionally like you do, or just sort of as an adjunct. I mean, where are some places or some things that attorneys and law students might need to think about if that's a path that they want to go down, either sort of informally part-time or more as a full-time job?
Sure. I mean, I think the initial answer is the same either way, which is get a lot of good practice experience under your belt. The sort of standard first year legal writing course tends to be pretty litigation focused, although I think that works well because so much of what I teach actually does transfer to lots of different writing contexts, where I think the converse isn't necessarily true if we, try to focus more on transactional law, for example. But what that means is that there are lots of opportunities. If, for example, you are a transactional attorney, you may find that there are lots of opportunities to teach on an adjunct basis, or that there's more of a need for people with that kind of experience. But either way, no matter what your practice background is, I suggest reaching out to your local law schools. To their, usually there's like a director of the legal writing program or a director of experiential education or an associate dean, and just say, look, here's what I do. First of all, like, law schools often need volunteers to do things like judge moot court competitions. Even if you're not interested in going into academia, I'm going to put a plug into your listeners to, you've got a bunch of appellate attorneys in Texas, and I have no doubt that you've got law schools there who always need to have, sort of people helping law students, right? It's about developing the future of the profession. So, really kind of, and it's fun to judge, to get to, to be the judge, right? In a moot court, and to help law students. I do suggest that you, if you're going to do something like judge a moot court or go speak to a legal writing class, that you ask the professor, like, what things would you like me to focus on? Either in my comments, in my feedback, things like that. Like, what would be most useful to you pedagogically? Generally, like, when I've had outside judges, local attorneys come in, they're really terrific and fabulous. And sometimes we actually have a conversation going, like, about, like, disagreements about, like, I think I do that, you should do it this way, and I, you should do it this way. And so students can see some of those things play out. But yeah, reach out. It's great. You start volunteering, and then, make your interests known, right? Like, if you ever need someone to step in and teach, X or Y or Z, here's a bunch of stuff that I feel like I could do. If you need someone to come guest lecture or kind of demonstrate, like, how I go about thinking through an appellate brief, like, I'd love to show you one I just filed and talk through some of the decisions that I made. Those can be great classes. And frankly, right now, when we're all, like, in a Zoom pandemic world, you don't even have to be, doesn't have to be Texas law schools, mm-hmm. right? You can zoom in anywhere. You can zoom into Michigan. So a lot of those kinds of things. And then, you know, if you're interested in making the transition sort of to teaching formally, whether on an adjunct or a permanent basis, the next thing that I'd suggest is really getting familiar with our pedagogy. And there are some ways to do this. There's a ton of great writing out there on what we teach and how we teach it, and sort of like everything from the cognitive science behind it to how like adults learn, to how do you put together like a good class, to how do you give feedback on student work. And there are a couple of organizations. There's the Legal Writing Institute, which you can Google and find pretty easily online. And there's another one called the Association of Legal Writing Directors, which also has a journal. I'm actually on the editorial board of that journal. And there's a lot of interesting stuff that gets published, both about what makes for good legal writing and analysis and research, and also how to teach it. So there's like a newsletter called The Second Draft. There's another newsletter called Perspectives, right? That both have shorter kind of essay sort of like teaching ideas. I just, you know, published one about a new peer review exercise that I tried last year that worked really well. So getting sort of like your feet wet so that you have a sense of how I know how to do this. I know how to practice law. How do I teach students how to do this is the next big thing I would really encourage interested attorneys to do.
What about people who are interested in going beyond getting their feet wet and doing the things that you're talking about, which are fantastic, but maybe even doing like you and making a career out of it. Mm-hmm. Do you have any different advice for those folks? I mean, I think from what you were saying, I think our experience is similar in that, you know, 25 years ago, the way that legal writing was taught is a little different than the way it's taught now, not only in terms of the approach to it, but also the allocation of resources. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that law schools weren't serious about it before, but you know, it seems like the profile has been raised.
I'll say it. The law schools weren't serious about it before.
I mean, am I right?
Who else and three else teaching it? It's hard to make the argument that they were serious about it.
Is it fair to say that the profile has been raised and that it's, you know, you hate to think about the legal writing professors as being, you know, treated as a different class of instructor? But it does seem like mm-hmm. that's still sort of pervasive, and maybe that's a view that needs to be broken through.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that a lot. I think two things are true. I think it is true both that legal writing as a profession has improved tremendously. And as a result, the law students' education around legal writing, which is like the core of what most lawyers do, has improved tremendously, right? Those things go hand in hand. Like the more law schools offer their legal writing faculty, the more they can attract and keep really outstanding legal writing faculty. And, you know, guess what? That makes a big difference for the quality of legal writing education that law students are getting. At the same time, it's also true that there is still more work to be done around things like pay and job security, right? Like I'm fortunate that at Michigan, I have a long-term contract. It's a 7-year presumptively renewable contract. I feel pretty secure, right? It's not tenure, but at the same time, I do some scholarship because I enjoy doing it. And I have a sort of like, there's a small piece of my sort of job requirements are writing, but I'm not like, the main thing that I do is teach. And I actually like that I get the expectation for me is that I get renewed as long as I continue to really focus on being an excellent teacher. There are some law schools that have a unitary track where it's just tenure across the board and the same expectations for scholarship that you see on the sort of more traditional non-experiential faculty side. And then there's some law schools that still have, I think, a ways to go in terms of establishing the conditions of employment that are going to attract really outstanding legal writing faculty.
It is interesting, I think, because going to law school in the early 2000s when I did, you know, you really did sort of have the separation and I think almost a different attitude between the doctrinal and the practice faculty. And that's was sort of passed down to the students. But looking at what I have done in practice and the skills that I use and the skills that I want the most for new attorneys coming in, legal writing and procedure are really far more important than I think any of the substantive topics that we covered, hands down.
Yeah. I mean, certainly as somebody who teaches this, it's essential. Like I think the primary reason, there's two primary reasons I'm as happy as I am at Michigan and why like I'm still here. And I was actually texting yesterday with my associate dean and he was saying, how are things going? I said, well, things are rough. We're in a pandemic, but I still love being here. Right. I literally said, I still love my job, right? And I love my job, and I love the, you know, four people that I live with, which is my husband and kids. So like, that's really what all you can ask for right now, because we're all stuck together. But yeah, I mean, the things that make it so great are like, I feel respected on my faculty, right? Like I feel like I'm viewed as an expert in what I do in terms of my participation in faculty governance. And I have colleagues on the non-experiential side who almost, you know, sort of almost unanimously sort of view what we do as being a really essential part of the law school experience. And the other thing that makes it great is that we have great students, right? And so those two things together, I think, are essential. So, yeah.
Well, we appreciate the time that you've spent with us today.
Yes.
Professor, we like to wrap up each episode with a tip or a war story from our guest. I would really love to hear what's something that would qualify as a war story coming out of a legal writing program, but we'll take a tip or whatever you have to offer.
I'll share a story that I share. It's actually not from my teaching experience, but it's a story that I tell my students actually right before their big oral argument on the summary judgment motion in the spring. And the students are really nervous, right? And they're getting up before someone who's a local attorney, who's going to be the judge. And I tell them about the case when I got admitted to the bar as a baby lawyer in DC, the very first thing I did is I went out and I got a pro bono case because I knew that I really wanted to do. Aiken Gump at the time had a partnership in DC with the Children's Law Center. And I really wanted to take one of these cases, these child welfare cases. And the case that I got was, it was a doozy. It was a family that had a lot of sort of interaction with the child welfare system and some really, really sad circumstances, as you might imagine. The client that I was assigned was a 5-year-old girl who had been raised from birth by a foster mother. And sort of the social worker agreed that the best thing at this point would be for the foster mother to adopt her. And the foster mother really wanted to adopt her. This little girl had had very little contact with her birth parents, but we had to do a termination of parental rights. And so this is the case that I tried in DC Superior Court over 6 days. And one of the very first things I had to do, I put the social worker on the stand and I had to get all of the social work records admitted under the business records exception to the hearsay rule. And something, you got my evidence, like sort of like class, I remember it all. And you know, you're a trial lawyer, like there's a foundation you have to lay and there's a bunch of questions you have to ask, right? Like, you know, did you keep these? Is it in your sort of like business practice to keep records like this? Yes. Did you in fact keep these records as part of your business practice? Yes. Do they accurately reflect? It's been a while since I tried, right? Reflect what, you know, did you work with
them? Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. And so then I stopped and I looked at the judge and I said, Your Honor, I moved to have these records, you know, admitted under the business records acceptance rule. And the judge looks at me and goes, you missed one. And I went, oh, and I'm like, going back to him, like, I said this one. And I said, I'm like, I thought I laid the foundation. No, right? And she kind of let me twist in the wind a little bit. And I was like, if I can't get the social worker records and then nothing, like the whole case falls apart. And the judge says to me, finally, after letting me kind of like stew and like, well, do you want to ask this? I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I want to ask. So I got the records admitted. I defeated a motion for a directed verdict at the end of our case, and we ended up winning the case. And I got this card from this little girl with like her school picture, which I still have. So I tell my students this story because the takeaway is like, you know, you can recover. So things happen in oral argument at trial. You feel like, oh no, like I'm never going to get past this. And like literally 2 minutes later, everybody in the room has forgotten about it. Like I still remember it 25 years later, 20, however many years later, but it's, you know, you can recover. So that's my story.
That is a great thing to remember because in the moment it feels like the worst thing in the world.
Yep. It absolutely does.
And probably everybody listening who's licensed has an equivalent story to that.
Nodding our heads, all of us. Yes,
absolutely.
You know, Beth, the way that I think you and I first got to know each other was through Twitter. And there's actually a surprisingly large community of legal writing professors out there on Twitter. Can you tell people how they can kind of find you and some of the other people that are out there that are good follows if you want to learn more about this topic?
Yeah. So my Twitter handle's easy. It's at Beth Walensky. So nothing very creative there, but I'm easy to find. And there are some hashtags which will find you, sort of get you into the professional legal writing professor community. I know that I have tweeted under LRW Prof, especially you'll find some threads about if you're interested in more details about how to become a legal writing professor, and you'll find a lot of faculty sort of from that direction. But yeah, and also if you just sort of search the LRW hashtag, you'll also find, I think, a fair number of us who are pretty active on Twitter because we will often append that. And then I also know that people use just hashtag legal writing. which again will get you not just legal writing professors, but I know a lot of people who think about legal writing on a professional basis, like all sorts of attorneys. And yeah, so I encourage people to come join us. It's actually, I found Twitter to be surprisingly engaging and educational and fun, and I develop some really great professional and personal friendships. So in spite of some of the things that are not great about Twitter, overall, I'm really happy that it's a space that I've sort of become active in.
Well, this has been great. We sure appreciate you taking the time to come on and be an out-of-state guest for us. It's been very educational, and we're just very grateful to you for taking the time to be here. Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@techsapplawpod.com, message us on Twitter or Instagram @techsapplawpod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at techsapplawpod.com or on Twitter @techsapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.